This is Talk is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. All right, I recorded a bunch of stuff at the anti-capitalist book fair up in Corvallis. I call it the anarchist book fair because there's a bunch of anarchist press there, AK Press and PM Press. So this today is Christiane Williams wrote, among other things, Wither Anarchism. And he gave a lecture. Basically, one of the things that was going on up there, one of the main topic everyone was talking about was how to keep violence, unplanned violence, and whatever you define as violence, out of demonstrations. And my point was, the point that I made was, during the WTO, the Teamsters had basically a parade permit. So if you want, so what we're trying to do is keep the bad elements like the white supremacists and anti-gay LGBTQ plus people out of the demonstrations who disrupt them. And we want people to be able to bring their kids to a demonstration, depending on who holds the demonstration. So that was a major subject. And like I say, we can't predict. You want to look at who made the demonstration, who is promoting the demonstration, to see whether you want to show up. But you are always going to be taking a risk bringing your kids to a demonstration. So, and the other thing I said was, I've always found it strange that my thing and my show is anti-corporatism. So I was saying, if you had changed the narrative, what you're calling it, words have meaning. If you change it to anti-corporate rather than anti-fascist, that might have softened the response from the white supremacists. And that's kind of what Christiane Williams spoke about, was his observations on the Portland demonstration against Trump back in 2016. And so just a little commentary here. You know, I'm not a Trump supporter at all, necessarily, but I'm just saying we wouldn't have Trump right now if, especially the Democrats, and if we had a third party, but if the Democrats hadn't grabbed their ankles for globalization back in the 90s, we might have had some resistance to globalization, and they sold out the middle class because they were not getting funding from labor. There was more funding from corporations in their defense. But again, if they had run Dennis Kucinich and run Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders and some of these other people like that, if they had pushed, I would have gone far left when the Republicans put up Donald Trump. And we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in right now. But so that, and because Congress doesn't act, that's why all these executive orders are happening. If you don't want the president to have authoritarian powers, you need to take action in Congress. So that's my little commentary, and that's what I see going on today. Also, one other thing is, we could have cut off, we've been telling them to cut off, to do sanctions against both Putin and Netanyahu for years, and they still have not done this. So what is coming out in the news now is that there is a way for countries to sanction Israel through the General Assembly, the UN General Assembly, when the U.S. Security Council blocks stuff. So that's, I suggest you go to Sam Husseini. Has information on that, and rootsaction.org has information on that. And with Putin too, we should have taken the Minsk Accords. We should have taken that agreement back in the Minsk Accords, because now he's not going to agree to anything, and he's going to take back even more territory than we would have gotten with the Minsk Accords. So that's what's going to happen. And again, now they're talking about sanctions. They should have seized the assets of the Russian oligarchs long ago. That was how you stop the war. Seize the assets. Don't freeze the assets. Economic sanctions don't work. What works is seizing the assets of these countries. And of course, that affects the American banking system people are less willing to bank with you if you are known for seizing assets. But that was how we could have stopped this war, and that's how ultimately we will stop these wars, is by seizing people's assets and arresting some public officials. So that's my spiel for this week. Coming up, Christian Williams from the Anarchist Book Fair in Corvallis. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
Philosophical Explorations, the work of Alan Moore. It's a collection of essays written over, I don't know, a dozen or so years. Consider things like the relationship between Watchmen and Heart of Darkness, and what Camus can tell us about V for Vendetta. And,
wow.
So, you know, a normal way of reading comic books. And the pieces weren't written to go together, but there are some through lines. And I'm going to sort of pull one out today and read from the very first page, a bit from the middle, and then the very end. And the line here is about the importance of imagination and the kinds of stories that we tell. And I'll be reading for about 10 minutes, so feel free to nap. And after that, we can, you know, I'll take questions, hear arguments. We could talk about superheroes. We could talk about why comics are better than movies. Like, whatever. At 17, Alan Moore was thrown out of school for selling hallucinogens. He declared himself a practicing magician at 40. In between, he rose to prominence as a writer, chiefly of comic books, and has distinguished himself by his gift for taking apart our cultural icons and putting them back together in different forms. Early in his career, Moore reimagined the Swamp Thing not as a human soul embodied in a plant, but as a plant that discovers it is something more like a god. In the figure of John Constantine, the magician's cloak became the detective's trench coat, and the noir anti-hero appears as a streetwise con artist at war with heaven and hell. V for Vendetta gave us the pulp hero as anarchist terrorist and anarchist terrorist as pulp hero. Watchmen asked what superheroes would be like if they lived in the real world, and what the world would need to be like to have such people in it. From Hell mythologized the Ripper murders as part of a century-spanning conspiracy, as somewhat later Providence and Neonomicon would revisit H.P. Lovecraft's weird fiction as prophetic revelations. Lost Girls uncovered the erotic potentialities of Victorian children's literature, elevated pornography to the level of high art, and proposed a politics centered on pleasure. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen pictured the entire literary canon as existing in a single coherent universe, whereas Promethea offered to open the frontier between imagination and reality. Since the 70s, Alan Moore has tinkered and toyed with both the eternal and the ephemeral. He is forever pulling new rabbits out of old hats, only to reveal that the rabbit is an ancient fertility god, and the hat the primordial abyss which miraculously contains all of existence in its very emptiness. Though equally, the god is a sock puppet, and the hat merely a satin-lined box with a false bottom. Moore has shown us a lot about how stories work and why they matter to us, therefore also revealing the architecture and codes of our broader culture, our collective psyches, and, if he is to be believed, the very structure of reality. Sometimes with humor, sometimes with horror, he has folded our culture back on itself to show us its heroic heights, its darkest corners, its absurd angles, and its complicated shadows. By doing so, he has changed the rules, expanding the boundaries of the medium and its genres. He has stoked our imaginations, broadened our sense of possibility, and thereby increased, if only inwardly, the scope of human freedom. If that's not magic, then I don't know what is. Jumping now to approximately the middle of the book. The myth precedes the reality. In From Hell, Robert Lees, a psychic advisor to the police, later confesses that his premonitions were always lies. I made it all up, and it all came true anyway. Moore later found himself in the same paradoxical position. At some kind of occult forum, one of the attendees claimed to have psychically confirmed the hypothesis of From Hell. Moore was quick to dismiss the idea as nonsense, replying, "Well, that's lovely, but I made it up." Still, he must have had his doubts. While researching the book, he found himself unnerved and amazed by the amount of confirming evidence that turned up to support my theory, precisely because it wasn't a theory, it was fiction. Yet that particular fiction triggered in him a philosophical crisis, which he eventually resolved by becoming a practicing magician. One would say a wizard if it weren't so awfully embarrassing. He started worshipping a second century snake god, a deity that he openly admits originated as a scam. He began speaking with the dead, summoning demons, and otherwise altering his consciousness in ways that straddle the line between metaphor and reality. Though he would likely say he is erasing the line, that in fact the line itself was always an illusion. Moore's epiphany came as he was writing a speech for his villain. Speaking through Alan Moore, the character also spoke to him. Sir William Gull, scientist and magician, doctor and killer, lectures, "The one place the gods exist is in our minds, where they are real beyond refute." Moore stopped, reread the words, and found himself in the thrall of a powerful new idea. "I thought I was writing this great piece of gothic villain dialogue," he told an interviewer. "But then I thought, oh shit, that's true." He later elaborated, "The world of fiction, the world of imagination, in some senses it is real. I think most of us would agree that thoughts are real. We have them, they pass through our minds. And if those thoughts are real, they are real in a different sense to the way the physical things are real. And it is in that same different sense that it seems to me that our fictional landscapes and our fictional characters are real. They have an effect upon us. These fictional people actually have an effect upon the real world. We create these ideal characters and we carry them around in our heads. We try to measure up to them and they affect our behavior. They have an effect upon our lives and thus upon our world. That would seem to me to grant them a certain reality." Moore reasons that if ideas are real, then they must have an existence, even a location, if not in space and time, then in a kind of eternal Platonic heaven. Idea space, he calls it in interviews, the immateria in Promethea, the blazing world in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. In Jerusalem, it is man's soul. One thing they all have in common is that when this Platonic space impinges on what we call reality, the result is the end of the world and the birth of a new one. This is a happy event in Promethea, more ambiguous in V for Vendetta, and both hopeful and horrifying in Watchmen, where the other dimension is itself entirely imaginary, in fact, a hoax. It leads to altogether less desirable outcomes in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, From Hell, the Neonomicon, and Providence. But in each case, the thing that changes the world is a story. A world reimagined is a world reborn. In separate occurrences, on the first and last pages of Providence, a man stands on a bridge and tears a book to pieces, watching as the pages fall into the river. It is a forceful, definitive image symbolizing not only the end of a story, but the disintegration of a governing narrative, a way of making sense of life, a worldview, a world. "Our lives, the world, it's all just lies," the journalist Robert Black had written in one of these books. "It's all just a story that we're making up until a more compelling story comes along." As one iteration of Promethea says to another, "The world isn't the planet or the life and people on it. The world is our systems, our politics, our economics, our ideas about the world. It's our flags and our banknotes and our border wars. The apocalypse," she points out, "might not be such a bad thing. I say end this filthy mess now." Our world is in desperate need of new stories, new imaginings, new ways of seeing, new ways of thinking, new ways of being. Our old story, the story of capitalist democracy and limitless growth, is very quickly running aground amid the realities of finite resources and climate change. The new story, that is emerging not only in Trumpian America but globally, is that of a paranoid nationalism, a myth of wicked semi-human outsiders poisoning our society and leeching off our strength. That's a bad, ugly, wrong story, not just because it relies on alternative facts, but because it cannot possibly lead us to any world worth having. It's a story that both aggrandizes and diminishes those who believe it. It's a story that distorts our idea of ourselves and disfigures our true selves in the process. Perhaps most distressing, that story tends to create the very conditions it describes. The racial hostility, the amoral power madness, the all-pervasive conflict in which everyone who is not an aggressor becomes a victim. Morally, the atmosphere itself suffocates us. All available space for beauty, kindness, or even ordinary decency shrinks until it vanishes. Even those who oppose the process succumb to it and eventually advance it. We respond to nationalism with nationalism, fundamentalism with our own fundamentalisms, suspicion with suspicion, paranoia with paranoia, hate with hate. When our fears define us, we become the monsters. If our culture is to improve, it is up to us to improve it. Alma Warren, the fictional Northampton artist and stand-in for Moore himself in his enormous prose novel Jerusalem, pursues what he describes as deranged agendas that involve affecting the development of culture and the subtle introduction of extreme ideas, which if pursued will almost certainly precipitate widespread apocalyptic psychological collapse. As she sees it, this is simply a matter of meeting the enemy on its own terrain, fighting with weapons that has long deployed to devastating effect. It's metaphors that do all the most serious damage, she says. Jews as rats or car thieves as hyenas. Asian countries as a line of dominoes the communist ideas could topple. Workers thinking of themselves as cogs in a machine. Creationists imagining existence as a Swiss watch mechanism. Such figures of speech or figures of thought have a way of ossifying. They come to structure our thinking, but such structures inevitably limit as well as support. They degrade into cliches and common sense, not even doctrine or dogma, but the inarguable assumptions that, and suppressed premises underlying actual belief. Our ideas become locks rather than keys. But then, by the same token, Alma thinks, it's just possible that art, her art, anyone's art, is capable of finally demolishing the mindset and ideas that govern the world, if expressed with sufficient force and savagery, sufficient brutal beauty. Better stories, better art, better metaphors will never be enough to put an end to the systems of domination that rule our lives and are rapidly destroying the natural environment. But in this age of conspiracy fantasies, incel manifestos, and stochastic terrorism, as the distance between culture war and shooting war increasingly narrows, we cannot afford to neglect the artistic dimension. It is in the imagination that ideals take hold. It is through the culture that values spread. We may not be able to imagine with any precision the world we want, but it is the imagination that enables us to see that things might be other than they presently are. Like the graffiti says, another end of the world is possible. That concludes our sermon. If there are questions or things that you wish I talked about besides that, raise your hand. Let me know.
And I'm not recording the Q&A.
The first question I have is, okay, so my mother took a class in abnormal psychology, and what they said was they have to study abnormal psychology to understand psychology. Is that what Moore is doing? He's showing abnormal, the extremes.
That's an interesting take. I mean, there's certainly part of his approach to, the super normal people in Watchmen, is certainly examining the way that their psychology would have to be different than that of, the rest of us. And some of that for characters like Dr. Manhattan, who's the only actually like superpowered person in the universe. It's a result of his powers that has changed his outlook. For others like Rorschach, it's the psychological damage that he, took on as a child that sort of leads him to the vigilante path that he's on. And I don't know if Moore is so much saying something about like the standard psychology of the rest of us as much as he's pointing to elements of the culture and elements of power relations and how they show like two things. One is how they show up in particular types of stories, and then the other is how they would shape the psychology of people like superheroes, if there really were superheroes. I would have to consider whether we can like reverse engineer an idea of his like superhero psychology back to a
a psychological theory about everyday people.
But I mean, he's taking things to their extreme to make a point, as much as science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly part of what he's doing. Is he's like, he took, you know, a sort of PG-rated vigilante like Batman or the Punisher, and, you know, turned it all the way up to create Rorschach, right? Which then lets us see, like, lets us reconsider, like, those other figures, like those figures like Batman or the Punisher, like what would they actually be like? What would their, like, how much of their action is actually admirable, and how much of it is simply troubling? Which I think is a question really posed by Rorschach as a figure.
Right, and then, you know, I read Lovecraft when I was like 11 or 12, and I remember going, well, these are the wrong people that won. There's something wrong. I didn't understand racism that much. I mean, I understood racism. We had busing when I was a child, but I didn't get that he was a racist. Is there a way to read Lovecraft that isn't racist?
Not really. I mean, the things that Lovecraft, like, you know, he talks about, on the surface, he's talking about, like, you know, unspeakable monsters and et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't take a lot of interpretation to understand that what he's actually afraid of is, you know, black people, poor people, people of color, women, sexuality in general. And that's sort of, you know, baked into his outlook. That said, there's a way of reading him that, so there's no way of reading him where his work isn't racist. I think there is a way of reading him that the reading isn't racist, which is looking at what the presentation of that as horror says about the anxieties of the time, and says about, like, not only his own psychology, but, like, the way in which he was typical of a man of a particular place in a particular class, and the way the things he was afraid of, he worked into these like demonic nightmare visions, but were actually very common anxieties in the society, in the milieu that he was in. And so I think what it can tell us about that society, and then also what it can tell us, I think, something interesting about sort of the racist imagination and the way that they imagine the world and the things that they're afraid of, which can lead to a somewhat richer understanding of what it is that motivates that kind of bigotry.
And McCarthyism and that too. Well, or McCarthyism was more about communism.
Right.
But they were racist too.
But you see similarly, like, I think looking at taking McCarthyism seriously, we can see some of the anxiety, like, you know, that's just wearing on the surface the anxieties of the society, right? And it tells us something about, you know, what elites especially were afraid of in the period immediately after World War II. And you know, they were afraid of, you know, what they called communism, and they were thinking, you know, the Soviet Union, etc. But, like, that fear meant that they saw basically everything that triggered in any sort of other anxiety in terms of communism, right? So they saw civil rights in terms of communism.
It's an invasion.
Yeah. And that also worked its way into the horror stories of the time, right? Like, you look at something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and it's a particularly interesting movie because on the one hand, you can read it as just a Cold War parable about being afraid of, like, you know, the communist infiltration. You look at it another way, and it's a parable about McCarthyism and the way that McCarthyism was, like, enforcing this kind of uniformity and homogeneity and, like, stamping the individualism out of American society. So these political motives and these social anxieties have their way of working into the culture. And sometimes one of the places that I think is most interesting to find that is in the horror literature, the horror movies, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I noticed that, I can't help but notice, it used to be, I was a geek when I was a kid, and these comic books were the purview of geeks.
Uh-huh.
And Game of Thrones, now I see jocks reading Game of Thrones.
Right.
And I see jocks doing this, and they're showing up at Batman. Any comment on that? How did that happen?
How did that happen is a pretty good question. I mean, one thing that definitely occurred is that it, like, the phenomenon you're talking about is that what were niche sort of geeky things became much more mainstream. I think some of that, like, in a way, like, okay, good. Like, I'm glad that, like, you know, jocks can read fantasy novels now. Like, good for them, probably good for society. On the other hand, that's had kind of a distorting effect on some of the culture, where rather than, you know, Marvel and DC, the two big comics companies, viewing their purview as a, like, relatively limited audience that they're appealing to with the best stories that will, you know, capture that audience, they're thinking ahead to whether this will get picked up as a movie. And that has that means that the stories that get told are different ones. That means that the stories are being made not with an eye to, you know, the best book we can put out this month or the best story arc for this year, but instead thinking, like, will this be a blockbuster movie? Will we be able to get Scarlett Johansson 3 years from now, right? And it's sort of like the difference between bands making music that they think their audience is going to like and bands making music that they think their record company is going to be able to license for an ad, right? And you're just going to end up with kind of a boring or product as a result of that. And I think that that's had an unfortunate effect on especially superhero comics, especially from the big two producers.
Well, because I haven't read more because I watched Watchmen, and I'm like, this is about violence, and this is just a violent movie. And you touched on this in your lecture, that even Moore doesn't like the way they have not emphasized, they've emphasized the violence more than the social commentary. And is that also what the jocks are looking at? I'm using the term jocks, but I mean, what people are looking for, the violence. They're attracted to the violence more than the social commentary. They're missing the message.
I think that is often true. And I think that's definitely been true with the way that the Moore's work was used in later in movies, for example. And then in, like, DC did some unlicensed prequels, which I understand had the same problem, although... again, I've only read the commentary on them. I've not looked at the actual things. Where while he was trying to make a point, like, about both about our society and also about sort of the assumptions of the genre, the conventions of the genre, people, especially immediately after Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns came out, they just saw it as a license to put in more violence, put in more profanity, put in more sex. And this is what passed as making comics for grown-ups, right? Whereas you would think that comics for grown-ups would have, like, you know, mature themes and developed characters and apply to adult sensibilities. And we got some of that too, but a lot of the more commercial stuff, a lot of the more successful stuff, a lot of the stuff that then also got, you know, made into movies, it took the spectacular and the licentious and left aside the, you know, what genuinely more mature themes, the sophistication, the character development, the political commentary. And that's something that Moore has been very vocal about disliking, about the effect that his work has had.
All right. And, let's see. I'll wrap this up. So Sin City and The Dark Knight came out after these, right?
The Dark Knight Returns came out the same year as Watchmen, 1987. I'm starting in 1986, but finishing in 1987, and which was just like a watershed year for, like, suddenly, like, comics could be taken seriously. It also, like, not superhero, but it was also the same year that Art Spiegelman's Mouse came out, which was a memoir of his father's experience in the Holocaust. And so... that year, like, there was suddenly a lot of attention given to, you know, things you could do with comics that couldn't be done before. Frank Miller, who did The Dark Knight Returns, went on to do Sin City. And his politics took, let's say, an unfortunate turn in the years following. Alan Moore went on to do I think, more and more interesting stuff for the whole course of his life until he very recently retired from comics and is now just doing prose work. Still good stuff, but like he continued to develop to see what he could do in comics for like another, you know, 30 years.
All right, so are comic books and science fiction, are they literature now?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, I think part of my project in The Illuminist was bringing the same kind of serious critical attention to comics as we do to other art, to literature. You know, I'm certainly not the first person to do that. The Comics Journal has been doing it since the 70s.
There's a class at the U of O on this very same thing.
So, but yeah, that's part of what I was up to was bringing the same critical attention that, you know, when I say, if you're wondering what Heart of Darkness has to do with Watchmen, I give both of them the same kind of critical treatment in the book. You know, I treat them as though they're essentially on the same level.
Is that going to happen? Is that going to be going to continue, or do you think, or people, is that going to expand or not?
You mean will they
trend? Is that trend going to continue?
Hard to know. I mean, I imagine that academics will continue to treat comics seriously for some time in the future. Whether the readership engages in it with the same level of sophistication, I think, is a different question, and I have no way of knowing that.
All right, I'm going to wrap it up here, but I have a couple of just strange ones for you.
Sure.
You know, you mentioned Camus and you mentioned V. Isn't the song Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that The Stranger? And is there a copyright issue? But isn't Bohemian Rhapsody The Stranger? It starts with Mother.
Yeah,
first line of the song is Mother.
Well, that had never occurred to me. I will definitely consider that, but I'm afraid I don't have a ready answer.
Or is there any copyright issue with writing a song based on Camus' The Stranger?
I mean,
that's what The Wall we
sure hope
not,
because The Cure's Killing an Arab is exactly the climactic scene from The Stranger, just put to music.
Okay, and also in The Wall, I thought Waters took it a little bit of it for The Wall, is in there
maybe
somewhere.
Maybe. I haven't seen The Wall in years, so
and
I
so
need to look.
All I could think of, too, is Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow, because I know V, you're talking about V for Vendetta, not V, Thomas Pynchon,
right.
But, you know, where he's talking about Nazi Germany and they have, these guys are having sex with little boys and the bombs are dropping where the guy has sex. So isn't that another example? Did Pynchon influence more, or any comments on Thomas Pynchon?
Yeah, there is a a handy list in the introduction to V for Vendetta of things that he took inspiration from. I don't remember if Gravity's Rainbow was listed, but I think that the novel V was, and is in fact quoted in the comic. So he definitely knows his Pynchon.
All right, anything else? You're working on a new book.
Yeah, I'm almost done with a book that's a history of policing in Portland, Oregon, starting with the first white settlers and going all the way to just after the uprising in 2020.
All right, is there a website you want to pitch? Or
my website is christianwilliams.com, Christian spelled with a K. You can find updates about what I'm writing or where I'm speaking, or if you're interested in buying books, you can find them there.
And you're with Anarchist Press, but other presses?
My publisher mainly is AK Press. The Illuminist is from Emergency Hearts, which is out of Austin. They're the two that I'm mainly working with now.
All right, thanks very much for your time and your great work.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, you have...
for the ones who get it.
Thank you.
Thank you.